Chapter 14. Sensitiveness that crawled in the muck for gold, that dreamed and aspired and gambled, and that passed and was gone. Only the dead things remained, the things that were not flesh, and nerves and sensitiveness, the sand and muck and gravel, the stretching flats, the mountains, the river itself, freezing and breaking, year by year, down all the years. When all was said and done, it was a scurvy game. The dice were loaded. Those that died did not win, and all died. Who won? Not even life, the stool pigeon, the arch-capper for the game life, the ever-flourishing graveyard, the everlasting funeral procession. He drifted back to the immediate present for a moment and noted that the river still ran wide open, and that a moose bird, perched on the bow of the boat, was surveying him impudently. Then he drifted dreamily back to his meditations. There was no escaping the end of the game. He was doomed surely to be out of it all. And what of it? He pondered that question again and again. Conventional religion had passed daylight by. He had lived a sort of religion in his square dealing and right playing with other men, and he had not indulged in vain metaphysics about future life. Death ended all. He had always believed that, and been unafraid. And at this moment, the boat 15 feet above the water and immovable, himself fainting with weakness, and without a particle of strength left in him, he still believed that death ended all, and he was still unafraid. His views were too simply and solidly based to be overthrown by the first squirm, or the last, of death-fearing life. He had seen men and animals die, and into the field of his vision, by scores, came such deaths. He saw them over again, just as he had seen them at the time, and they did not shake him. What of it? They were dead, and dead long since. They weren't bothering about it. They weren't lying on their bellies across a boat and waiting to die. Death was easier than he had ever imagined. And, now that it was near, the thought of it made him glad. A new vision came to him. He saw the feverish city of his dream, the gold metropolis of the north, perched above the Yukon on a high earth bank, and far spreading across the flat. He saw the river steamers tied to the bank, and lined against it three deep. He saw the sawmills working, and the long dog teams, with double sleds behind, freighting supplies to the diggings. And he saw, further, the gambling houses, banks, stock exchanges, and all the gear and chips and markers, the chances and opportunities, of a vastly bigger gambling game than any he had ever seen. It was sure hell, he thought, with the hunch a-working, and that big strike coming, to be out of it all. Life thrilled and stirred at the thought, and once more began uttering his ancient lies. Daylight rolled over and off the boat, leaning against it as he sat on the ice. He wanted to be in on that strike. And why shouldn't he? Somewhere in all those wasted muscles of his was enough strength, if he could gather it all at once, to upend the boat and launch it. Quite irrelevantly, the idea suggested itself of buying a share in the Klondike town site from Harper and Joe Laju. They would surely sell a third interest cheap. Then, if the strike came on the Stewart, he would be well in on it with the Elam Harnish town site. If on the Klondike, he would not be quite out of it. In the meantime, he would gather strength. He stretched out on the ice full length, face downward, and for half an hour he lay and rested. Then he arose, shook the flashing blindness from his eyes, and took hold of the boat. He knew his condition accurately. If the first effort failed, the following efforts were doomed to fail. He must pull all his rallied strength into the one effort, and so thoroughly must he put all of it in, that there would be none left for other attempts. He lifted, and he lifted with the soul of him as well as with the body, consuming himself, body and spirit, in the effort. The boat rose. He thought he was going to faint, but he continued to lift. He felt the boat give, as it started on its downward slide. With the last shred of his strength he precipitated himself into it, landing in a sick heap on Elijah's legs. He was beyond attempting to rise, and as he lay he heard, and felt the boat take the water. By watching the treetops he knew it was whirling. A smashing shock and flying fragments of ice told him that it had struck the bank. A dozen times it whirled and struck, and then it floated easily and free. Daylight came to, and decided he had been asleep. The sun denoted that several hours had passed. It was early afternoon. He dragged himself into the stern and sat up. The boat was in the middle of the stream. The wooded banks, with their baselines of flashing ice, were slipping by. Near him floated a huge, uprooted pine. A freak of the current brought the boat against it. Crawling forward, he fastened the painter to a root. The tree, deeper in the water, was traveling faster, and the painter tautened as the boat took the tow. Then, with a last giddy look around, wherein he saw the banks tilting and swaying, and the sun swinging in pendulum sweep across the sky, Daylight wrapped himself in his rabbit skin robe, lay down in the bottom, and fell asleep. When he awoke, it was dark night. He was lying on his back, and he could see the stars shining. A subdued murmur of swollen waters could be heard. A sharp jerk informed him that the boat, swerving slack into the painter, had been straightened out by the swifter moving pine tree. A piece of stray drift ice thumped against the boat and grated along its side. Well, the following jam hadn't caught him yet, was his thought, as he closed his eyes and slept again. It was bright day when next he opened his eyes. The sun showed it to be midday. A glance around at the faraway banks, and he knew that he was on the mighty Yukon. 60 Mile could not be far away. He was abominably weak. His movements were slow, fumbling, and inaccurate, accompanied by panting and head swimming, as he dragged himself into a sitting up position in the stern, his rifle beside him. He looked a long time at Elijah, but could not see whether he breathed or not, and he was too immeasurably far away to make an investigation. He fell to dreaming and meditating again, dreams and thoughts being often broken by sketches of blankness, wherein he neither slept, nor was unconscious, nor was aware of anything. It seemed to him more like cogs slipping in his brain, and in this intermittent way he reviewed the situation. He was still alive, and most likely would be saved, but how came it that he was not lying dead across the boat on top the ice rim? Then he recollected the great final effort he had made. But why had he made it, he asked himself. It had not been fear of death. He had not been afraid, that was sure. Then he remembered the hunch and the big strike he believed was coming, and he knew that the spur had been his desire to sit in for a hand at that big game. And again, why? What if he made his million? He would die, just the same as those that never won more than grub stakes. Then again, why? But the blank stretches in his thinking process began to come more frequently, and he surrendered to the delightful lassitude that was creeping over him. He roused with a start. Something had whispered in him that he must awake. Abruptly he saw 60 Mile, not 100 feet away. The current had brought him to the very door. But the same current was now sweeping him past, and on into the downriver wilderness. No one was in sight. The place might have been deserted, save for the smoke he saw rising from the kitchen chimney. He tried to call, but found he had no voice left. An unearthly guttural hiss alternately rattled and wheezed in his throat. He fumbled for the rifle, got it to his shoulder, and pulled the trigger. The recoil of the discharge tore through his frame, racking it with 1,000 agonies. The rifle had fallen across his knees, and an attempt to lift it to his shoulder failed. He knew he must be quick, and felt that he was fainting, so he pulled the trigger of the gun where it lay. This time it kicked off and overboard. But just before darkness rushed over him, he saw the kitchen door open, and a woman look out of the big log house that was dancing a monstrous jig among the trees. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.